From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, and this morning we're going to kick off the show with Kara Jaimo, author of the new book, Leaving the Ocean Was a Mistake, Life Lessons from 60 Sea Creatures. Now, this is a beautifully illustrated book that shares insights into some of the ocean's deepest and most curious creatures, to some of its cutest as well.
That's right. Then we speak with Gary Ferguson, nature writer and author of some 20 books on and about the outdoors, including his most recent one, The Twilight Forest, an elegy for Ponderosa in a changing West.
All that and more coming up on This Green Earth.
Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Now joining us is science writer Kara Jaimo, who has just released a new book called Leaving the Ocean Was a Mistake, and it's a beautiful book for all ages and something that I think everyone can glean something from. Kara, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get into a little bit about your background and what led you into these writings. You've been a science writer for years. You write for many magazines. You do a lot of article writing, and you've written a book called Atlas Obscura, which we've talked about on this show. But now you have written this book that was beautifully illustrated by Vlad Stankovic, and it is called Leaving the Ocean Was a Mistake. We love to dissect our human relationships on this show with wildlife and marine creatures and all that. And so here you've developed this book about sea creatures and their behaviors and turned it into almost a self-help book. So can you tell us how you got to the premise of this book and a little bit of your background that led you to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, I have been writing for many years about science, and I found myself writing quite often about some of the stranger creatures that we share the earth with, both in terms of covering new research about kind of weird and wacky critters, and then also, yeah, in my last book, Atlas Obscura Wildlife, which was a huge collection of them. And often I kind of come at them in a straightforward way because, you know, their lives are really interesting and the things we're learning about them are fascinating in themselves. But for this book, me and my editor at Quirk, we decided to take a slightly different approach and spin some of the facts we know about these sea creatures' lives into little bits of advice that we as humans can also learn from. So the idea was kind of to make it so that you're flipping through and not only are you learning about these animals that might seem really different from us, but you're sort of seeing the ways in which we all have things in common, even with the creatures that live at the very bottom of the sea.
Yeah, and you divide the book into the ocean zones. Can you describe these zones and why you organize the book in this way?
Yeah, so these are zones that ocean researchers use to kind of like divvy up the ocean into almost different ecosystems. Like just like land has different places that are characterized by different plants and animals, the ocean has different zones depending on the depth, like how deep these creatures live. So in the book, we start with the sunlight zone, which goes down about 660 feet. This is the part of the ocean that gets the most sunlight, and the creatures here are sort of the most familiar. And in the book, you'll find that their advice is a little bit the most familiar. Sometimes it's even like a little bit cheesy on purpose. It's meant to kind of ease you into the concept. Then we move on to the twilight zone, which has less light and goes down to about 3,300 feet. The advice and the creatures get like a little bit stranger down in the twilight zone. You're getting into a little bit more unusual territory there. Then we go to the midnight zone, which is quite dark, quite deep, quite hard for humans to access. And the critters there are really funky. That's down at 13,000 feet. Mm. And then finally, we get to the abyssal zone, which is the strangest zone of all. A lot of the stuff going on in the abyssal zone, we don't even know yet because it's just so, so hard to get there. But there are some facts we've gleaned and some encounters that submersibles have been able to have down there, but that's 13,000 feet down. So it's hard to even imagine. The animals down there live in conditions that are hard for us to imagine, but then you see them and you realize like, you know, we're still alive on this planet together and there are things we can learn from them. But those pieces of advice are kind of the most surreal and the weirdest. We wanted to kind of track the weirdness and the funniness of the advice with the depth that the creatures are found at.
Yeah. And I'm curious, how did you choose the creatures that made the cut? Did you start with a multitude of them and then pare them down? Or did you start with a few and then grow that number from there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I knew I wanted about 60 because we wanted this book to be, you know, this size. It's pretty like easy to flip through. And as I was going, at first I thought, you know, okay, I'll just list a bunch and then I'll narrow down. But especially at the deeper depths, there actually aren't even that many species that we know enough about to be able to draw them or to have a fact to share. So in the deeper depths, the list kind of made themselves. Like I was searching around for anything that I could find that we knew about that lived down there. Places like the sunlight zone, there was a little bit more picking and choosing. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to display, you know, a variety of life forms and lifestyles as much as I could.
Well, in the sunlight zone, I'm guessing, is the star tunicate. What is the star tunicate, and what is a life lesson to learn from it? Yeah, you describe so it as it, if you're happy. Sure. Yeah, if you're happy and you know it, digest your brain.
So this is the life form that has a bunch of different, you know, morphological forms that it takes over the course of its life. Like you can think of it almost like how a frog grows from a tadpole, mm-hmm. that grows from an egg. Like its body plan is going to change. For the star tunicate, it starts out swimming around, but then once it finds a good spot to live, it sort of settles and its body changes completely. It digests its own tail, it digests its swimming muscles, and then it also digests a lot of its brain because it just doesn't need it anymore now that it's not mobile. So we just figured, you know, if you if you're in a position in life where you're happy and you know it, maybe you don't necessarily need to think about it as much as you did before. And you can take a little bit of a break. You can kind of take a load off.
Yeah.
Yeah, you kind of nailed this scientific approach along with this balance of, again, you know, these self-help, I guess, little messages about how we can live our lives. So I think it's really beautiful how you have balanced that in the book and made it so easy to digest. And my favorite is actually the leaf sheep, because I've never heard of them. And a lot of these, I guess, I can admit that I've not heard of, but I like, don't just touch grass, become grass, because I think that speaks to how we interact with the world, but that their own bodies are creating this photosynthesis is just so magical to me. Can you walk us through that creature?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's totally worth, you know, like looking up a picture of the leaf sheep. If you are near your computer, you have your phone handy, because they're so cute. They're like some of the cutest animals I've ever seen. But they are a sea slug called leaf sheep. And a lot of sea slugs have really cool abilities that they're not necessarily like born with or have automatically, but they get them through what they eat. So there are other sea slugs that can eat, you know, venomous microscopic organisms, and then they themselves become venomous or stinging or whatever else. And for the leaf sheep, it's kind of an opposite power. It's sort of like a productive power where they can eat algae that lives under the sea, and then they absorb the algae into their bodies rather than just digesting it. The algae starts kind of working for them. It photosynthesizes, it takes sunlight and makes it into energy, which is a skill that generally only plants like algae have. But it gives this energy to the leaf sheep. So it becomes this cool symbiosis. And yeah, the advice from them is don't just touch grass, become grass. Yeah, there's always a way in which you can get closer to the creatures that live around us, just like these leaf sheep do.
Yeah, it looks literally like the illustration in a way that's amazing. It's almost like this little Pixar creature. So totally. Yes, encouraging people to look up leaf sheep. And you know, you wouldn't think a slug to be a cute creature, but it definitely is worth taking a look at. And it's a beautiful illustration in this book. Is there a creature in particular that stood out to you as you were writing this that you maybe had more of an affinity for than any other?
Yeah, there are definitely a bunch. I learned so much about the ocean writing this book. It's not a part of the world that I have gotten to, you know, quote unquote, dive into quite this much before. And I was really excited for the chance. But I think the one that I like to talk about the most, it's a little bit unorthodox because it's the only creature in the book that doesn't exist anymore because it's a prehistoric creature. But we have an advice line that's, it's never too late to go back to the ocean. Mm-hmm. Animals originally evolved in the ocean. You know, a lot of the things that we associate with being an animal were first formed underwater, which is kind of cool to remember. And then, you know, a bunch of those animals, or at least one, came onto land and they diversified from there. And we have all the land species we know today. But there's one creature named Pachycetus. Kind of looks like a little dog. And, you know, its ancestors came on land. And this one creature, Pachycetus, sort of decided somehow to keep living close to the water. And then at some point, its descendants went back to the ocean again. Hmm. So first it came onto land, then it went back into the ocean. And they're the ancestors of modern day whales and dolphins. So before we had whales and dolphins, we had these kind of little seaside dogs called Pachycetus. And whenever I see a whale or a dolphin, I think about that, because the journey that we've all taken to become what we are today is really fascinating. And a lot of it kind of ties the land and sea together.
And it speaks to that title too, Leaving the Ocean Was a Mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
so the idea behind the title is, you're right. It's tied to that. We did leave the ocean. Our ancestors left the ocean a long time ago, but maybe we shouldn't have.
And I guess it's a little too late to go back. Although we try to get in there, you know, we need to actually, Carol, we need to spend more time in the ocean, particularly the mm-hmm. deep parts of the ocean, because there's so much yet to discover and understand about creatures down there. Like you say, it was kind of slim pickings when you were looking for a sample creatures. But yeah, we need to spend more time learning about our planet by spending more time down in the deeper depths.
Yeah, not as an extraction, but as an understanding.
Yeah. Well, while we're down there, talk about the fan fin anglerfish. The life lesson there is described: if you love someone, absorb them into your bloodstream. What is going on with that fish?
Yeah, anglerfish are really funky. There are a number of species. We have the fanfin anglerfish here. It's really cool looking, mm-hmm. And also very scary. And already, I think, in a Pixar movie, actually, since you were talking about Pixar, I think these fish are in Finding Nemo.
Yes.
But this particular type of fish, the females are much bigger and scarier looking than the males, which are tiny. And when the females and the males mate, the males kind of just like attach to the females. And over time, the female absorbs the male into her body. They start, you know, sharing a bloodstream. And he loses a lot of his most important features, although he does not lose his testes, which are important for reproduction.
Right.
So that's why the advice is, if you love someone, absorb them into your bloodstream. It's not necessarily advice that you have to take. It's just something to consider.
Right. and also... just last week or so, there was a new type of species called a snailfish, and specifically a bumpy snailfish. I don't know if you saw any videos of that, but as an example of more marine life that's still to be discovered down there. And it's actually very cute looking. It's most deep sea creatures are more like the anglerfish, Kara. But this one is actually kind of cute, the bumpy snailfish. Check that one out if you haven't seen it.
Well, yeah, I think that this book is such a great intro into, again, caring about the ocean, or a greater understanding of what's living there, and just the fascination it has for all of us to see how many different creatures. I mean, my goodness, there's so many different ones in this book that, again, I would have never thought were an actual life force on our planet. And it's really interesting to see this, and to also, like I said, have that balance of the humor that's in there as well. As a science writer, was it cathartic, or did it feel good? In writing about science these days, I think it might be a little bit heavy, but did it feel good to be able to put out a book that was filled with a little lightness and brightness and some humor to it as well?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's really interesting to be a science writer that focuses specifically on, you know, like unusual creatures and new discoveries in biology, because on the one hand, so many wonderful things are being discovered every day. And then I'm discovering wonderful things for myself every day, because there's just so much cool things happening with life. And then on the other hand, you know, there is species extinction. There's, you know, the insect decline crisis, there's ecological collapse, there's climate change. There's also a lot of difficult things happening that really affect, like, as soon as I learn about something, I often learn about something that is threatening it, you know, and like you mentioned before, even deep sea exploration, which, you know, we're learning more and more about who lives down there. Mm-hmm. The flip side of that coin is, like you mentioned, different resource extraction projects that are slated to happen, mm-hmm. even in the deep sea, mm-hmm. before we even really know what's there. We're thinking about dredging it up and changing those environments a lot. So there is always that there, but I do like to focus on the positives and just like how amazing the world is and all the creatures that live on it, because I feel like if people understood that a little bit better, yeah. it would be easier for us to make decisions together that prioritize that.
Absolutely. I want to squeeze in one more because I've never heard of this one, this type of shrimp, the fire-breathing shrimp. Is that its actual name or is that just something that it does?
I believe, you know, another kind of funny thing about these creatures is like the only people who encounter a lot of them are scientists, right? Like, yes. Your average person is not diving down deep enough to see a fire-breathing shrimp. So it's kind of like whoever sees it decides what to call it. Oh. And somebody decided to call this the fire-breathing shrimp, which makes a lot of sense because this shrimp's defense mechanism is that inside its body, it stores this blue goo that when it kind of like barfs it out, the goo glows bright blue with a bioluminescence.
Okay.
So it's cool. It's like a glow stick. Like you crack a glow stick and it's suddenly very bright. When this shrimp goes like bleh, this bright neon goo comes out and it freaks out whatever's trying to eat the shrimp and then the shrimp can escape.
Okay. Defense mechanism, escape mechanism in a sense.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So when it's threatened by a scary fish, it just kind of poops out this glowing cloud. And the advice line for the fire-breathing shrimp is, it's good to get it all out.
That's right.
Well, coming back to these advice lines, how long did it take you to research and put all of these together in this way and to come up with these lines or these titles on that self-help, I guess, little plug?
So honestly, the book didn't take too long to write, mm-hmm. time-wise, but it was sort of like an obsession for the short period of time that I was kind of in crunch time writing it. I was really thinking about it a lot, and different things that happened to me would make me think of these specific creatures I was reading about, and then I kind of was able to link them up with some advice. And my editor at Quirk was a big help in that, which I really appreciate. But it was very fun to think, like you said, think creatively and kind of try to think from the perspective of these animals, like in a whimsical way. I enjoyed that exercise a lot.
Well, a lot of times we will put a human thought or feeling onto an animal, and it just makes us, I think, feel a little bit more connected to the species around mm-hmm. us if we feel like there is something that we can innately share with them. And I just think this is a really fun way to learn. It feels like it is for all ages. I got so much from it, but I'm sure kids flipping through, there's so much for them to learn. So it's right. almost like a great practice for the whole family to get into and maybe read even one a day.
Thank you. That's a nice idea.
So Kara, what are you working on now? What's next for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like you mentioned, I'm usually like more of a freelance journalist. I've written a couple books recently, but I also really love writing for magazines and newspapers. So I'm getting back into that. You can probably find my writing in the New York Times and places like that, just kind of trying to keep everybody apprised of the latest in creature news.
And so you do stick with creatures, and as a person who's a freelancer, you get to delve into a lot of different topics and become the expert in that moment about those topics, doing that deep mm-hmm. research. Is that something that really feeds you to be able to take on different topics and then really dive deep into them so that you can relay them to all of us in a way that we can absorb it?
Yeah, it's really fun. That's kind of my favorite part of my job, is I learn about something and then I get really curious and I sort of have carte blanche and an excuse to reach out to whoever knows even more about it, whether that's a researcher or somebody else, and just kind of absorb everything I can and then, yeah, try to present it in a way that people who are, you know, just flipping through the paper or like scrolling before work will want to learn more about. Because again, that's kind of my mission, is just like get everybody on board with the fact that this world is really full of beautiful life.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Kara Jaimo, who is a science writer and has just put together this beautiful illustrated book called Leaving the Ocean Was a Mistake, illustrated by Vlad Stankovic. And it's just come out, correct?
Yes, it's just out. And yeah, if you know, this topic strikes your fancy, or if you know anybody who maybe needs a little bit of sea creature advice in their life, I hope you check it out.
Absolutely. And where can they find out more about you, your writings, and how to get their hands on this book?
Yeah, totally. So the book should be available in most bookstores. If you want to keep up with me and my writing, I do have a newsletter on Substack. It's called What's New in Animals and Plants. I haven't been keeping it up quite so regularly with the book stuff, but I'm planning on starting it up again and bringing everybody interesting animal and plant news at least a couple times a month, and also sharing my writing there.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Kara, for being a part of This Green Earth. I hope everyone does go out there and check out this book, and then we can have more deep conversations with our community around some of the creatures that are in the deep depths of our oceans.
Thanks, Kara.
Thank you guys so much.
And joining us is Gary Ferguson. Gary is a nature writer, author of some 20 books, including his most recent one, The Twilight Forest, An Elegy for Ponderosa in a Changing West. Gary, thank you so much for joining Claire and me on This Green Earth.
It's a pleasure to be with you both.
Well, usually we like to start things off with get a little background on our guest. Tell us a little bit about yourself and nature writing and your experiences in that field.
Yeah, I grew up in northern Indiana in what I often refer to as a topographically challenged place, South Bend. And I told my parents when I was 9 years old, having seen some photos of the Rocky Mountains, that I was going to, by hook or crook, move to the Rocky Mountains. In fact, when I was 13, I laid out this plan that I had from saving money, shoveling snow and mowing grass. I was going to ride my bike from South Bend to the Rockies in Colorado, and I laid it all out and explained how it was going to work and told them I'd be back in time for school. And remarkably, they didn't let me do that. Nonetheless, I had that urge for that wild country of the West in general. Since I was young, and as soon as I was able, I went out and trained as a naturalist in the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho. And shortly thereafter started working freelance, living in a cabin 7 miles from the nearest road I had to get to on a snow machine, and typing up query letters and manuscripts on a manual typewriter, and then once a week snowmobiling them into the van and driving the van to Flagstaff to type them out on an electric typewriter so they'd look good and send them off. And it was, you know, it was a humble beginning, but over 5, 6, 7, 8 years, things started to roll. And I moved into books in the mid 80s. And of those 20 plus books, they've all been about nature and the environment. For me, nature and the environment, when I was a kid and a teenager especially, really held me at a time when things were pretty tough in the family and in things going on in my life. Mm-hmm. And so I came to associate nature with that sense of belonging and that I was okay, and you know, a sense of connection and kinship that I've never lost. It, right. If anything, it just grows more the older I get.
Well, is it true that you worked for the Forest Service for a period of time as an interpretive naturalist?
Yeah, that's right. And that was in Stanley, Idaho, in the Sawtooth Mountains. And I would go out early in the summer and stay into the fall, working for a magnificent mentor who was a naturalist and a retired Navy guy, and just absolutely loved the land and was obsessed with learning everything he could. And he was such a good teacher. And so those 4 years just, you know, threw wood on the fire as far as my life was concerned. I was more convinced than ever that being in and around wild places, and perhaps especially the West, was going to be something that I would do the rest of my life.
And now you've penned this book, The Twilight Forest, An Elegy for Ponderosa in a Changing West. What is your relationship like with the Ponderosa pine? Because it sounds like you have this very intimate relationship and emotion around this certain area, and you utilize this as a central symbol throughout the book, and it also reflects on a bigger landscape than that. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes with all that's unraveling in the face of climate change and lack of biodiversity and things like that, it can be overwhelming for any of us to know what to do with that much loss. And so I think it's valuable, perhaps for others, it was for me, to just choose one place to walk through the door of grief about what's happening to a particular thing that you care very much about. And if you do that, you'll not only, of course, you'll feel sad and you'll have the grieving experience, but you'll also come to a very deep heart place, being thankful for anything that can develop that kind of a care and loving relationship in you toward it. And so I picked Ponderosa for my door at this point in time because one thing on a practical level, I worked for years for National Geographic Book Division and tended to do adventure backpacking, long trips, sometimes a couple months out in the wilds. And that was a way for me to really get out into wilderness and begin to be, I guess, humbled by it, to become right-sized, I think, by it. And so to have this tree that, first of all, in all those miles that I just mentioned, that I was backpacking, and I think it's around 30,000 miles, that Ponderosa tree often on some of those trips was what literally gave me shelter. It blocked sun on super hot 100-plus days in the Southwest, and it sheltered me from sleet and hail. So on a practical level, I appreciated the tree for that. But it goes way beyond that. Those forests that mature Ponderosa form are like your vision of Eden in some ways, of a forest. They're very spacious. Old timers used to say you could drive a wagon through them. And the canopies aren't heavy, so the light comes softly filtering down through them, widely spaced. And the trees themselves, the mature ones, 3 to 4 foot diameter, made up this deeply furrowed cinnamon colored bark that smells, I kid you not, it smells exactly like either vanilla or butterscotch, depending on your senses. Right. And so that tree also would become to me where I went when I had some of the biggest losses of my life. I've lost a lot of significant people, I think, before their time. My father from an accident when I was 24, my mother 7 years later, my wife of 25 years, just passed her 50th birthday in a canoeing wreck we were in up in Ontario.
Wow.
So in each of those circumstances, as you can imagine, when you're grieving, you look for comfort, and comfort comes from a lot of places. But for me, comfort came from the Ponderosa forest. It not only made me feel safe, but made me feel like through that beauty, I would be able to ultimately muster what I needed to rise and to walk through that grief journey and to get to the other side. There was a great calm confidence that I know it sounds sort of woo-woo, but that came to me from those forests. And so between practically them doing so much for me, and then also, you know, the real personal connection I had during times of big loss, that's, I think, why I chose the Ponderosa. And to be honest, one other thing practically for this book, this is, in my mind, the Southwest, the big Ponderosa belt from central New Mexico all the way to the Sierras of Southern California and up the Sierras. That is disappearing at a frightful rate. Hundreds of millions of Ponderosa are already gone, and they're, in a lot of places, they're not coming back. They're turning into permanent grasslands. And that makes that gigantic Ponderosa belt such a big part of our culture, our movies, our artists, our photographers. I think it's going to be reasonable to describe it as the first post-climate change landscape in America, because there is no real bench in the Southwest for other with a bunch of other trees like there are in the Northwest or the East. If you lose a couple species, the forest still has its infill. But in the Southwest, the ponderosa is the one tree that's managed to survive in high, dry desert conditions and reach a tremendous stature. That's it. That's the vertical in the Southwest. The pinyon and juniper are wonderful, but they're very modest little trees. So it will change the way this place looks and feels. And those forests also, finally, I'll say, support about 250 different species of life. So not that all those species will go extinct, of course, but they'll be displaced and some of their populations will no doubt be trimmed.
What is the typical lifespan of a ponderosa? And you alluded a little bit to it. Tell us a little more about the role ponderosa play as far as providing an ecosystem, serving as an ecosystem.
Yeah, ponderosa will grow routinely to 400 or 500 years. Wow. There have been a couple found that were about 1,000 years old. That would be exceptional, I would say. But that is not the easiest thing to find these days because we had eliminated 95% of the old growth of all trees in the West by the 1960s. So the ponderosa is important for a lot of reasons. It's the most widely spread pine in North America. Hmm. So in a lot of the West, this is the forest that would hold those critical snowpacks, which are unfortunately shrinking and disappearing more quickly. But they hold those snowpacks, and by holding the snow, they allow that snow to percolate down through the soil. That gives the water for life that bring in a lot of other creatures. It waters itself, but also that's what sends those excess water down into the aquifer. And it's from those aquifers that, you know, people in the cities and the farms and whatnot draw to get their water. So if you remove the forest, besides losing what was living there, you also expose the snowpack to just wide open grasslands. And so the snow will melt much, much faster, mm-hmm. and much less of it will go in the ground and become part of the aquifer. So that's going to be a very significant thing to watch. I mean, even if you manage to replant ponderosa, and that's got lots of problems with it, it's going to be a long time before you'd have a forest that could perform the function of a middle-aged ponderosa forest today.
All right. Well, we can kind of roll out the usual suspects as far as what is threatening ponderosa's future. You know, is it logging, fire, drought, beetles, all of the above, or does one take a primary position?
Well, I think there are two sort of overarching things that have come together to create a perfect storm. One, without question, is climate change, because climate change has reduced moisture, dried things out, the temperatures are up, the humidities are down. That creates the kind of conditions for wildfire that can be absolutely devastating. Mm-hmm. And with drought related to climate change, the Southwest right now is in its 31st year of consecutive year of drought. Mm. So this is a big era. And under that kind of stress, drought stress on trees, all kinds of trees, they become very susceptible to beetle kill and mistletoe and blight infestation. And so you could say, well, climate change didn't kill the tree, blight did or beetles did. But if it wasn't for climate change, those particular agents would not have taken hold in the same way. So climate change is a big part of it. The other thing, though, and this is a real lesson in humility for me, has to do with the fact that from roughly 1915 to the 1970s, we had a policy for wildfire in the American West that was insanely overaggressive. In 1934, the head of the Forest Service said, we're going to have the 10 a.m. rule. So any fire that starts, lightning strike, whatever it is, we're going to have it out. The Forest Service will have it out the next morning by 10 o'clock. That's a crazy fantasy. That would never be possible. But it's a look into how obsessed people were, our land agencies were, with eliminating fire from the landscape. The indigenous people tried, who had been using fire on the land for thousands of years, tried to share their wisdom, but we knew better. And so we entrenched for about 70 years this policy where all the fires really got put out that we possibly could. There's a big problem with that in the Intermountain West, the arid West. The only way that branches and dead tree trunks and other things referred to sometimes as the biomass go back into the soil so they can, you know, nourish the new flush of life. The only way that really happens in the arid West is through fire. There's not enough moisture to support the microorganisms that really help facilitate rot, if you will. Mm-hmm. So fire comes through, burns it, and in the ashes, all those nutrients and minerals are held. And so the post-fire growth can be absolutely magnificent for plants that can settle quickly. So that's a real important thing all by itself. Is if you take the fires away, you're going to starve basically the soil and the earth. The other thing, though, is regular maintenance fires, which we think going back thousands of years, came along every 5 to 7 years. They tended to have flame heights of 15 to 20 feet, maybe temperatures 1,200 degrees. They're fairly modest. They would start by lightning, of course, often, or sometimes I'm sure some intentional burns by indigenous people would have gotten away from them. But they burned regularly enough and they kept things healthy. And one of the other things they did was to burn away excess bunching of trees, which mm-hmm. can happen sometimes if the growth conditions are good. You get a lot of bunch trees. Right. And so without the fire, those bunch trees weren't being taken out. And so today we have not only a lot of fuel load from dead trees that have fallen, about 300 million acres of it, three times the size of California. But we've also got a lot of other consequences that are starting to show themselves from this aggressive fire suppression. There are places in Arizona where, let's say, in 1900, you would have found 100 to 150 ponderosa trees per acre, you know, a nice, healthy, mature forest. Mm-hmm. Now that same acre can have 5,000 trees. So that tells you the difference that putting out all the fires made. So now we have all of that fuel, some dead from piled up logs, some from bunched young trees. We've got trees under stress being killed by beetles and other sources, and so they're dying off. So you get this massive fuel load, and then you put, again, to end the circle, you put climate change under that massive fuel load. And sometimes you'll have fires burning so hot that they'll sterilize the soil. These are fires, I said earlier, the healthy maintenance fires were 15 to 20 feet flames. These are 200, 250 foot flames, 2,000 degree temperatures. These are the mega fires that are often referred to today, 100,000 acres or bigger.
Right.
And that's just an enormous size fire. And since 2000, they've just been increasing, and there's no question. I think they will.
Yeah, I think we have a really difficult time sometimes grappling with the darker parts of nature and what we define as maybe darker parts of nature, but really is nature acting upon itself to keep everything alive and well in this web that it creates with all of us here on the planet, not just the pines with the species that live there, but also that interconnectedness with us as humans. And maybe under a lens of hope, I guess I'm going to ask this question. You're utilizing the ponderosa pine as a jumping off point in the natural world to talk about climate change and our relationships with the earth. What are some very specific messages, I guess, that you're hoping these readers will take away from your writing in this book and actions that maybe you'd want them to take?
Well, first of all, you know, encourage whatever, no matter how small things you do, to keep doing them. They do matter. There's a lot of people who say, oh, what does it matter with corporations doing what they're doing? Collectively, what we do as individuals does matter. The second thing I'd say, to keep your spirits up, Bill McKibben's often asked the question, well, what can I do as an individual? You know, I don't have any power. I can't. Mm-hmm. And his answer is almost always, well, first stop doing things as an individual. Mm-hmm. Be with other people, no matter how small your project might be. If it's planting trees, if you're in the West and the ponderosa grows, a lot of volunteers are needed to collect ponderosa seeds, mm-hmm. so that after these mega fires, the forest can try to be replanted from seedlings from those seeds. So there's all kinds of things you can do to volunteer. Gardens in the inner city are hugely important. And all the different organizations you support, that's all really, really good. But beneath those practical things and supporting people in political office, I'd say, who are understand the danger of climate change and are for trying to figure out something we can do with it. But underneath all that, there needs to be some heart involved too. So do what you can to nourish yourself from the natural world and not just be its protector and defender, but be in deep relationship with it. One of the things that's, I think, going to have to change ultimately, you know, we've got all the technology, we really do, to solve pretty much the whole climate change thing. But we don't always have the heart and the will. And that heart is really something we need to focus on. And I think it begins almost with, of course, new stories. Meaning for humans come from the stories they tell. And I think we need to tell stories that really do celebrate the fact of interdependence. There is no such thing on planet Earth as a rugged individual. Nowhere. Nowhere, never has been. This thing works because it's relational. You know, I don't stop at the edge of my skin. Yeah. I'm taking in oxygen from the trees. They're also exuding phytoncides, which help strengthen my vital organs and my heart and whatnot. I've got more microorganisms in my body that came to live with me after I was born than human cells. And they help me take the nutrition and give it to my body so that it can keep living. So we really do live in an interdependent world. Mm-hmm. And the more we can tell stories about that interdependence, about that community, about that kinship, how it works maybe, but also just what it feels like to live with that as a leading thought throughout your day. I just invite people to play with that because it's, I think, some of the first magic we need to get through the next 10 or 20 years.
Right. And not to mention the fact that, you know, trees serve as therapists many times. Trees and forests, therapy.
Yes, thank you. That's so true. I mean, and not that it needs it, but you know, there's been this onslaught of research showing people who go under trees or through woods, mm-hmm. what happens to their, you know, cortisol levels, mm-hmm. their blood pressure, their heart rates, their, you know, all of these things are actually literally affected by us being in relationship. And so thank you, Chris, for saying that. That's so, so important.
Yeah, we talk a lot about that on This Green Earth, about our interconnectedness with nature and how it affects our world around us,
our spirit,
whether it's, yeah,
our
history, our emotions, our art, our spirituality. It's
culture.
All part of us kind of doing that forest bathing sometimes to get reconnected with the earth. So I appreciate that perspective from you, and also that perspective of how that goes into environmental conservation and how we care for the planet.
Right. Is there a Ponderosa Protection Society, Gary, or something similar that people can learn more about Ponderosa?
You know, there is not, although
well,
perhaps.
What are you waiting for?
Yeah. There should be. I have my future charted for me.
The PPS, yes.
There,
Gary.
We go.
Yeah, yeah.
I
oh,
like
I like
this.
It. That's very catchy.
Well, we'll be your first members.
All right. Oh, thank you. Good.
Charter
good.
Members.
Thanks for rolling on that. Yeah.
Well,
but there are lots and lots of organizations,
yes,
that are, and appropriately so, focused on regional, I'd say, watersheds, or, you right. know, watersheds among in a smaller area. And that's where the volunteer work a lot of times happens to care for that land, whether it's urban or not. Yeah. And so coming up that way, there are a lot of places that Ponderosa happen to be part of what those groups are trying to protect. And that includes, you know, encouraging prescribed burns, which are one way to eliminate all of that or most of that debris I mentioned earlier, and the bunching of the trees. We can go in and, if the conditions are right, burn in that kind of healthy fire way that used to happen all those years ago. That's something that even citizens are helping to some extent facilitate with their support. And then also there are mechanical thinning operations. I'm less of a fan of those, but anyway, there's not a Ponderosa Society per se, but depending on where you live, I know there are several in California, and they happen to be concerned and caring for lands that are heavily covered in Ponderosa.
All right. Well, the name of the book is The Twilight Forest, An Elegy for Ponderosa in a Changing West. The author is Gary Ferguson. Gary, website people can go to learn more about this book and your other writings.
Yeah, the website is easy. It's www.fullecology.com.
Okay. Well, thank Perfect. You so much, Gary. We appreciate you being a part of this Green Earth today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review, and we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.